Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode 747 of the podcast, and it is Saturday, the 20th of April, 2024, as I record this. In today's show, I have a discussion about the mid-list indie author with T. Thorne Coyle, where we discuss creative and business practices for those of us who make a decent or even a very good living without being super famous or a seven-figure author outlier. So that's coming up in the interview section. So in publishing industry news, excitingly, Book Vault have launched bespoke publishing options in their dashboard. So now you can order gorgeous books with all kinds of extras, ribbons, custom foiling, custom end papers, head and tail bands, new thicker paper stock and more. So I'll be using these options to the full for my next Kickstarter for Spear of Destiny, but you can also use them to do print on demand, all printed in the UK and shipped from here. You can find out more at bookvault.app. But I'll link to this in the show notes as well. And of course, my Writing the Shadow and Sasha Black Ruby Rose latest book as well, used as examples. Very proud of those. Now, crossing over publishing into AI, HarperCollins partners with 11 Labs for non-English audiobooks, as reported by Publishing Perspectives. From the article, the agreement will lead to the production of audio versions of select deep backlist series books that would not otherwise have been created. Without AI, there simply wouldn't be the time or resources to make this happen. And this is the reality with audio. And of course, there's all kinds of uproar about this in various places. But the fact is, most books are not in audio, full stop, and most books that are even in audio in English language are not available in audio or even in ebook or print book in many languages in the world. And this is where we're going with a lot of this stuff. People make a big fuss about certain things, but this is opening up a whole load more content to people who wouldn't be able to get it otherwise. For example, a Bulgarian friend of mine asked if he could listen to my audiobooks in Bulgarian, and I said, definitely not right now, but maybe within the next few years. At the moment, it would be impossible for me to pay for translation to Bulgarian and then pay an audio narrator in Bulgarian, as well as every other language on the planet. But that's not going to be an issue for much longer. Now, I believe we can do both. And years ago now, like 5 years ago, I said we should have stratification of audio rights. So we would have premium human narration, and maybe you only do that in English since this is an English audience. And then we have AI narration, AI translation into other languages. It is not one or the other. It can be all of it. And this is what we have to think about. It is an amplifier. AI is an amplified intelligence. It, yes, some jobs are going to change, but we need to think of amplification and the more possibilities that are coming. So yes, as 11 Labs said in this press release, now every author can see their work come to life in audio, readers can be offered more choice, and the linguistic barriers of content can be dissolved. And the reality is most people can't afford to do audio with humans. Certainly most independent authors, it's just way expensive. I personally have been doing that with humans for years and have just paid my narrator for a few more books in a series. But when, as things change, I would like to do other editions as well. So, for example, things I've narrated as a human narrator, as a British woman, I would love to have in other voices, male voices, for example. So, yeah, I think there are many opportunities ahead and we just have to embrace the opportunity. And 11 Labs is also partnering with Storytel. So fingers crossed, Spotify will enable the use of their files for Findaway Voices, which they do not at the moment. You can only use Google Play audio through Findaway Voices, but that's not as varied. So I think things will be changing in the next 6 months, although I think I said that last year, but maybe hold off a little bit longer. If you are a patron, I have an interview with Leanna Morgan about how to use 11 Labs for audio, so check that out if you're in the community. And on this, I did want to share a tweet from Stephen King on X this week. He said, "I'm not worried about AI because I got my mojo working." And I love that because that is how I feel. My mojo is working with AI tools. And those of us who are trying to use it as part of our processes for business and marketing and creative projects, it's a useful partner. That's the thing. And it actually amplifies your mojo. So I loved hearing that from Stephen King. And of course, X is primarily, now Grok AI has come out of X, and X itself is powered by an AI algorithm. So even if Stephen King doesn't think he's using AI, he sure is. And I'm glad he's not worried about it. Also, in AI news, in terms of podcasts, two new podcasts out this week about AI and publishing for writers. First of all, it's just AI Publishing Formula. So you can just put in AI Publishing Formula with Mel Melkumian and Jamie Culliken. And that is definitely more focused on marketing at the moment. There's only one episode out as this goes out, or maybe two by the time this goes out. Also, Brave New Bookshelf with Steph Pajonas and Danica Favorite. So, and they're talking, I guess at the moment, again, they've just done one episode. It's more about their background. Really interesting and fantastic to hear more enthusiasm about use cases for AI in the creative community. And remember, you can use the tools for marketing and business, even if you don't want to use them for creativity and writing. So yes, that is AI Publishing Formula and Brave New Bookshelf. Give them a try. In personal news this week, I've been hardcore editing. So Spear of Destiny came back. So I worked through that and sent it back for the final proofread. I also edited the De-Extinction short story, which is a stretch goal on the Kickstarter. So I am really moving into finishing energy, which means it's all about publishing and marketing in the next phase. I need to get my Kickstarter campaign sorted and start making the marketing assets for the launch. I like to have everything done before the launch because it feels too much otherwise. At least 80% of it, I guess, done beforehand. The Kickstarter pre-launch page is at jfpenn.com/destiny. I've also got some long-awaited admin to sort out this week. And as I mentioned X, and I'm really looking again at how I use X, trying to treat it as an entirely new platform, trying to forget that it used to be Twitter, trying to begin again almost. And so thinking about a lot of things I've been putting off, you know, when you're in that creative phase and you're like, I really do not even want to think about a lot of this admin and blah, blah, blah. But now I do. So there's a whole load of things come up to the top of my list, which I need to get done. So business and marketing in the week ahead, plus a research trip to a Gothic cathedral, because I just can't help myself getting started on another project, although that project will definitely be a longer one. So thanks for all your emails and comments and photos. Thanks to Don, who sent a lovely picture from his car, said, "Pleased to receive Writing the Shadow in today's mail, all the way from the UK. I wanted the print book, not just the ebook, and opened it in the parking lot." So it was a lovely picture. I do love to see pictures of people holding my books. I know that's an ego thing, but come on, it's just lovely. Also, Day Tripping Rock said on Instagram, "I was listening to this episode of The Creative Pens," that was last week, "as I pulled into the Mount Hope Cemetery to see the daffodils," which I mentioned as a patron mentioned that last week. A listener mentioned last week. Is that serendipity, synchronicity, happenstance? I can't explain it. So thank you, Day Tripping on Instagram. That was just lovely to see. And also beautiful daffodils in that Mount Hope Cemetery. So please leave a comment on the podcast show notes at thecreativepen.com or on the YouTube channel, or message me on X at thecreativepen and email me. You can send me pictures of where you're listening, joanna@thecreativepen.com. I love to hear from you. It makes this more of a conversation. This episode is sponsored by Pro Writing Aid, because however you choose to publish, whether you go direct to readers or you go indie or you want a traditional deal, you need to make your book the best it can be. ProWriting Aid is one of my absolute must-use tools in my writing process. I use it for every book, every short story, and in the last few weeks, I've been using it for Spear of Destiny and the De-Extinction short story. So how I use it is I open ProWriting Aid on my computer, and then I open my Scrivener project within it. I work through each chapter, which is more manageable than doing a whole document. It suggests improvements, and I don't accept all the changes, but it certainly helps me find a lot of problems. And of course, you don't need to use Scrivener, you can use it with Word or other writing software as well. ProWriting Aid knows all the rules of editing and helps you apply them. And of course, you can choose not to make changes as you like. It helps with making your writing more active, finding repeating words, finding words you can improve, sentence structure, Grammarly, punctuation issues, typos, spacing, and more. So why use software to help you? Why don't you just learn all the grammar and writing rules and apply them yourself? Well, we all use tools to improve our process, and we are also often blind to our writing issues. It helps to have another pair of eyes, even if the eyes are software. So won't a human editor do all this? Well, yes, they can do, but I'd rather pay my editor, Kristen, to fix the things that the software can't. As brilliant as ProWriting Aid is, it cannot read the manuscript as a whole or comment on bigger issues like character development or inconsistencies or plot holes or structure for nonfiction. So I use ProWriting Aid as my essential editing tool before sending to my human editor. You can check out the free edition or get 25% off the premium edition by using my link, prowritingaid.com/Joanna. prowritingaid.com/JOANNA. So this type of corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting, transcription and editing, but my time in creating the show is sponsored by my community at patreon.com/thecreativepen. Thanks to the 11 new patrons who've joined this week, and thanks to everyone who's been supporting for months and years. If you join the community, you get access to all the backlist videos and audio covering lots of topics of creativity, including creativity, business and AI. There are tutorials, there's mindset stuff. And last week, I did my monthly Q&A audio, an hour of answering questions from patrons, basically an extra solo show. The Patreon is now a monthly subscription, the equivalent of buying me a black coffee a month or a couple of coffees if you're feeling generous. So if you get value from the show and you want more, come on over and join more than 1,000 authors. Thanks to all patrons who've been supporting the show. You're amazing. And I'm so glad you find the show useful after all this time. Join us at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, let's get into the interview. T. Thorne Coyle is the author of paranormal mystery, urban fantasy, alt history, epic fantasy, as well as non-fiction around magical practice. Their latest book is The Mid-List Indie Author Mindset. So welcome back to the show, Thorne.
Thanks so much. It's great to be back.
Yes, I know. And I had a look. It's been 6 years since you were last on the show.
That's a long time, especially especially in the indie publishing world.
Yeah, I mean, we're old school, which probably means we met like a decade ago.
Yeah, probably.
Which is so funny. So let's assume people haven't listened to our episode from 6 years ago, and also things have moved on. So tell us a bit more about you and how you got into writing and publishing.
Well, I was one of those people, you know, I've written since I was a tiny child, probably age 5 or 6, and wrote poetry. Did journalism as a teenager, wrote for tattoo magazines in the 80s and 90s, and really wanted to write fiction. And I would practice writing fiction, and then I finally just gave up. I was the classic. I would labor over a short story for a year. I would stall out 3/4 into a novel. But I loved writing nonfiction also, and that was easier for me, less of a challenge. And so I got my first nonfiction major publishing, traditional publishing contract 20 years ago. I sold a book to Penguin and gave up fiction and focused on nonfiction and traveling the world and teaching for a decade and 2 decades. And then fiction came back. Some characters showed up in my head one day and I started writing fiction. I started studying craft. And then started seriously publishing, indie publishing. I decided I didn't want to go trad. My first nonfiction books were all traditional published. I didn't want to go traditional for fiction. because I saw the struggles my friends were having with traditional publishing and my own struggles with traditional publishing. Started seriously indie publishing in 2017. And here we are today. And I've got a big catalog now, and I just keep going.
Yeah. So what is a big catalog?
Well, I have probably, including short story collections, probably 30 books, which for me is a big catalog. I know for other people that's a tiny catalog, but it might even be more than 30 books now. I fail to keep track.
I mean, it's also funny because you sounded slightly apologetic about 30 books, and I do this too. And it's like, this is ridiculous because there's plenty of authors who write 2 books in their whole life.
I know people like that. I certainly know a lot of traditional authors who only write a couple books, and that's great. It's just a hard way to make a living.
Yeah, exactly. So let's get into the book. So the Midlist Indie Author Mindset. I feel like this word midlist probably means more in the traditional publishing world. So why don't we start with that? What is the midlist and why use that concept and what does it mean?
The reason I latched on to the concept of midlist, and you're right, it does come from traditional publishing. So I'll give a little background. In traditional publishing, especially in like the 70s, 80s, and 90s, midlist authors were the bread and butter authors. They were middle class, they weren't bestsellers, but they put out books people enjoyed year after year after year. And they were the backbone of a lot of publishing for a long time. So the bestsellers financed the non-sellers, the poor sellers, but the midlist just kept going, writing books people enjoyed. That slowly faded away as traditional publishing changed. It became harder and harder to make a living as kind of a middle-class midlist author. And the other thing about midlist authors is they had a big catalog because they just kept publishing year after year, usually genre fiction of some sort or another. And they built up a catalog that people enjoyed that in traditional publishing is called a backlist. We still use that terminology, but it's not really accurate for indie publishing. Backlist, in traditional publishing, frontlist is a brand new book that they push for 3 months. That's what that means. Mm-hmm. Backlist is everything else, right? So we can just call it our catalog because as indie authors, we can relaunch, we can do whatever we want with all those books. They're not going to go away, right? So I wanted to bring forth this concept of midlist into the indie world because so many people say, well, if I'm not making multiple 6 figures or 7 figures, I'm a failure, right? And I believe it's possible for a lot of people to find ways to make a decent middle class living as writers. And it's a lot more attainable and sustainable than some of the tactics and techniques people use to grow to be multi-six, like high 6-figure or 7-figure authors, right? And it can feel discouraging, I think, to a lot of people when we see these success stories and think, well, I may as well win the lottery or get struck by lightning, right? That's how unattainable it feels. And I realized in my own life, I had to curtail some of my ambitions because of life circumstances, and realized what I really wanted was a slow, sustainable build and a long, sustainable career. And if I can do it, I think a lot of people can do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the problem is that the midlist is, it's not a very sexy goal. It's not very catchy,
right?
You know, 6-figure, 7-figure. But as you say, it's more like the slow build, sustainable living, sustainable lifestyle, things that actually give us a good life. And sometimes I feel like you have to be careful what you wish for. And in the book, you talk a bit about your jet set lifestyle, you know, you used to travel a lot, teaching. So what happened to that? Like, when did the romance disappear from that lifestyle?
So it was around 12 years ago, I really stopped wanting to travel all the time. I was traveling all over the world constantly, like sometimes twice a month. I was on an airplane. And it was wonderful. I met amazing people. I saw amazing places and I was getting paid to do it. But unbeknownst to me, my undiagnosed chronic illness was getting worse. So that was starting to happen. And also I was just burning out. I was burning out on having to be this public figure, even though it was in a small sphere. I was burning out on the travel. And I'll never forget one time I came back from a trip. I crawled into bed and said, I'm done. And I still had 6 months to a year's worth of trips booked. Right. So I just had to get through that time and then recalibrate and figure out what to do. And that's when I did my major pivot. And it also coincided when those characters showed up and I started studying fiction again. So yeah, I burned out really badly, which I know a lot of people do and need to make career change. So I realized I still had those ambitions. I took some of my ambitions into the indie writing sphere early on before I realized that was not going to be sustainable. There were things people were doing that were all about the fast build. They were all about the spikes, you know, make the huge income right away. And I was trying to do that and failing and had to reassess and say, okay, what can I actually do? And so I slowly figured it out for myself.
Yeah, and what do we want to do as well? And it's interesting that the characters came back at the point at which you said, I'm kind of done with that life. And so you opened up space in your mind for that. And I talked about that this years ago when I made a decision to opt out of my career. I still have 5 more years of that IT consulting career, but right. I opted out of the career ladder. So I did what I needed to do to make the money and to do a good job for my boss. But I knew I was leaving, and that opened up the potential for what then came next. And I feel like a lot of people don't realize that you almost need to make the space, like for you, for the characters to come back.
Yes. And in the book, I talk about having a possibility mindset. And that's what you're talking about, right? Mm. Making space for what is possible is really important. And it gets easy to just get on a hamster wheel and never just take a full breath even, and ponder, as you've said, what do I want? Not only what's right for me and what's sustainable or possible, but what does my heart want? What does my soul want? You know, what's interesting to me? So I always try to invoke curiosity, and I've invoked curiosity around writing fiction, but over the years, I've learned also to invoke curiosity about running a business. And that was my huge mindset shift. When I decided to get curious about business instead of treating it like a loathsome, horrible task, right? It changed everything for me.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute, because I do remember having a conversation with you. I think we might even have talked about this on our last discussion on the show. You're a strong activist. You have very strong principles, and money and capitalism were just things that you kind of hated. And so you were pushing away money. But tell us how you got over that, how you reconciled this.
Well, I still don't like shareholder capitalism and the effects it has on the world. I can say that. But since for me, what I want to do is connect with people. And that's always been my task as a creative. And that's also my love as a business person, right? So I need to run a sustainable business and take interest in it and figure out ways to engage with it in ways that are going to help me connect with people, right? That's all my business is. I run a publishing company that's about connection, right? So reframing that for myself, that it's not about who gets the most toys. It's about, here's the world we live in, and what are my options for connecting with people and trying to make the world a more enjoyable, less horror-ridden place, you know. And the other thing is, I'm always a proponent of culture change. And one of the best ways to bring about culture change is capturing people's imaginations, right? Mm. So if I want to capture someone's imagination through my stories, I have to figure out a way to reach them with those stories. So I have to figure out how to run a business.
Yeah.
So I think that's what helped me get curious.
Yeah. And I mean, to reach more readers, it's better to have a bigger engine in your business. And I also remember you saying to me, if I make a ton of money, I can always give it all away to the causes that I care about. Yeah. So that, I think it's a really good reframe for people, is to accept that if you make more money as an author, it's because you're selling more books, you're reaching more people.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And people are excited about my books. People are excited about your books. And people need fiction right now, and nonfiction too. But gosh, the world needs wonder. The world needs hope. And if we can supply even a little bit of that for people, how awesome is that?
Yeah, and escapism as well. As we record this, I just binge watched The Three Body Problem on Netflix, and I hadn't read the book. And as soon as the series finished, I was like, right, I'm buying the book. And I learned today that the Three Body Problem trilogy and The Silent Spring, Rachel Carson's book, which they use in the series and is in his book, went to number one on Amazon because everyone's buying these books. And I just thought that was brilliant because, again, it's such a resonant story at this time in history. Like you say, these stories have power and they connect minds, and it's so powerful. And I feel like sometimes we almost degrade writing fiction, like, oh, we should write something more important, in inverted commas.
Right. And that's also the great divide between, like, high literary fiction and what we call genre fiction. We think, oh, my cozy paranormal mysteries are not important. Well, actually, my cozy paranormal mysteries, those are my best sellers, because people need that escapism. People need some comfort, you know? And so why isn't comfort important? Why isn't enjoyment important? I recently talked with author Meg Ellison, and she really talks a lot about the importance of pleasure in life. And I agree with her. We need pleasure. We need joy. Everything can't just be hard all the time, because we won't make it through, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And for me, the pleasure is going to bed with a book is still a big pleasure.
Yeah, right, right.
Sometimes I, you know, just so tired and I go to bed in the afternoon and I'll read fiction. And other times I'll read nonfiction. Like I read your book on the plane, coming back from 20 books of ill. There you go.
Oh, that's what nice.
Yeah, so it was, it's a great book. I do want to come back on the one point in the book. You say, my readers love my work because I'm weird. And I talk about doubling down on being human, but I think it is easier said than done, especially in this world where there's a lot of advice around chasing tropes or writing to market or any of this. So how can authors find their particular kind of weird and also have this confidence to let it out into their work?
Well, first of all, what comes most naturally to you? That's the main thing. And we often make the mistake that what comes most naturally to us and what we really love and feels easier for us isn't important. But we think it's too ordinary, right? But what's ordinary for us is extraordinary for something else. It feels ordinary to us because it's just part of us. And when we allow that voice to come forward, people respond to it because they're like, oh, that's an authentic voice. You're not putting something on. You're actually connecting with me, and I'm connecting with these characters, right? So I'll give you an example. I had been writing my alt history and kind of more serious urban fantasy, and I was in the middle of writing my epic action adventure trilogy, and I needed a break. I had got a concussion and a brain injury, and I started writing my cozy paranormal mysteries, which are just bonkers. And I did a Kickstarter for them, and I was very nervous because I thought, wow, this is really different. People aren't going to like it. People came out of the woodwork to back that Kickstarter, and my first reader for the cozy mysteries said, well, you know, these cozy mysteries, cozy readers tend to be more traditional. They're not going to be into the fact that you have bisexual characters and transgender characters and all this stuff. And I thought, you know what? I'm just going to market this as cozy mysteries for freaks and geeks, because I like cozy mysteries and I'm weird. Clearly now I realize, oh, other people who are weird also want the comfort of cozy mysteries, right? They're not all traditional readers, you know? So I was told very clearly, cozy readers are traditional. And I said, I don't care. These are the books I want to write. And lo and behold, they found readers. And it might take a little more time, which is why I talk about the slow build in the book. It might take more time, but you're going to find your readers.
Yeah, I do want to comment on this because you're a super strong person and you're very clear on your freaks and geeks side.
Yeah.
And your visual brand. Let's just speak to the people who might not be that strong in their knowledge of what their weird is. So what about people who are like, oh, I don't have that strong sense of what is my weird? How do we find that? How do we tap into that?
Again, you mentioned earlier making space. You know, if we make space for ourselves and listen to our heart and what's most interesting to us, rather than listening to the clamoring voices trying to tell us what we should be doing, that's the first way through. It's just to pause, go for a walk, meditate, ponder for a while, and think, what am I actually drawn to? Not what the marketers are telling me I should be drawn to. And that's how to find ourselves and find our path forward, I think. It just starts with listening and making space to listen.
Yeah, and it is really hard. I mean, the world is super noisy, you know?
Yeah.
You could just spend your time endlessly scrolling, whichever social media it is, or doom reading the news
yeah.
or whatever. And then your brain is full of all those things that it thinks that it should be interested in. So where do you find it? I mean, maybe it is in the books you read when nobody's watching.
Yes. Yes, I think that's brilliant. Yeah, what are your so-called guilty pleasures? And put all that in your writing.
And it's interesting because I mentioned the three body problem again. So I don't read sci-fi because yeah. I'm like, I'm not into aliens. And then watching the three body problem, I don't know why I didn't realize this before. It's not about the aliens. It's about the humans.
Yeah. And it always is.
It always is. And the thing is, I really like reading horror. And people are like, oh, why do you like horror? And I'm like, well, it's not about the monsters. It's about the humans.
Yeah.
It's all just exactly the same, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. We're all just trying to make sense of the world, you know, in our own way. And it doesn't matter what genre it comes through. I think it's the joy of writing is we get to figure out the world. And we either get to try to figure out the world we live in already, or we try to figure out what world we want to live in. Right?
Yes. And write that into whatever alt world you're doing. It is interesting. I think, well, let's come to the marketing, because you said in the book, you say, I figured out how I market, not how other people market, which has a similar sense of finding your own path. So just talk about some of the things you tried but failed on and what does work for you?
I'll go back to that word connection. Figuring out that for me, marketing is about connection was helpful. And actually, you helped me with this years ago. We were at some conference and you said, oh, Thorne is great at content marketing. I went, I am. I had no clue because I was just doing what I was doing, right? It was natural to me. And then I went, oh, okay, that's content marketing. I post what's interesting. It's still related to my world. And that's how I market. The things that didn't work for me were early on, first of all, I didn't have a big enough catalog to do advertising for, but everyone said you have to do advertising. So I was taking the Amazon ads and Facebook ads classes, and they didn't work for me. Turns out all that advice at the time was really only useful for people in Kindle Unlimited, but they weren't telling me that. The other thing that never worked for me were like Facebook group takeovers, newsletter swaps. Because I don't write the kind of urban fantasy these other people are writing. So doing a newsletter swap isn't going to really work because I don't know if your readers are going to really like my books, right? Mm. Now, I eventually figured out, oh, certain kinds of advertising works for that. Like if I did a free first in series and did the paid newsletters, I wasn't trying to target other people's readers. I was just targeting people who said, oh, we want urban fantasy or we want cozy mystery, right? So I don't have to bring my entire catalog to these people. I'm bringing them one series. And then if they find the rest of my catalog, that's great. The other thing that didn't work for me, again, was that spike marketing, trying to do promo stacking and get the big spikes and hit lists and all that. It was never going to work for me. That was all feeding the beast. And I also don't think, even for the writers that was working for, I don't think it was a long-term strategy, right? Mm-hmm. So I had to figure out my long-term strategy, which was, how do I connect with my readers? Well, I do that through my newsletter. I do that through how I use social media. I do that now through things like Kickstarter, right? And so over the last 8 years, I've built up enough goodwill with my readers that they are so happy to share my stuff now, right? And it also means when I do any paid advertising, I'm strategic about it and it works. I'm not just throwing spaghetti at a wall.
Interesting, though. You said the spike marketing hasn't worked for you, but Kickstarter is short-term promotional window. So how are you doing that? What kind of marketing are you doing within the 3 weeks this will run?
That is a great point. So spike marketing for wide retailers didn't work for me. Spike marketing for direct sales does work for me. So I've built up all this goodwill through how I use my newsletter, how I connect on social media. So whenever I go to run a Kickstarter, people are like, we are sharing your Kickstarter everywhere. We're so excited you're doing this. We're backing you just because we like your work, right? So I do market those, but I do it in the regular ways I do everything else. I use my social media platforms. I send out notices in my newsletter. I don't do anything special for my Kickstarters. It all is organic for me.
It just has a time limit. So you're basically just sending out some newsletters. Obviously, you're doing some podcast interviews like this one.
Yes.
But are you running any paid ads for your Kickstarter? Have you found them useful?
I spend like $20 on each campaign.
That doesn't count.
So I don't. I don't do paid marketing. Some people do. I don't. And my Kickstarter campaigns all do really well.
Mm. So how many have you done now?
This one will be my ninth.
Okay. So what's the kind of tempo? Because obviously we're talking here about the life that you people want to live and designing your business around that. So what's the tempo of your Kickstarters in a year and how do you manage the different releases?
I do three a year, and three a year seems to work for me. I thought I was going to do four this year and it was way too much, partially because I ran a big for me Kickstarter campaign last year that brought in like $25,000. And since I'm doing it all myself, it was big. And I had trouble with my printer. So it took a lot longer to fulfill than I wanted. And so I'm like, okay, I need to take the fourth Kickstarter off my plate this year because everything just got backed up, right? Business-wise. Mm. But three a year works for me because this is my full-time job. For people I know who it's their part-time job, they run one a year. And it's a great way to make money for covers, pay for editors, and build a new audience. Which is the other thing I love about Kickstarter is about half of my backers come directly from Kickstarter, which is awesome. And then about half come from my world.
Yeah, from your audience. I feel like this, when I do Spear of Destiny, which will be my first fiction Kickstarter, and I've done two nonfiction, memoir and then the writing nonfiction. I'm doing it under the same name, and this will be my first thriller. And I feel like I'm going to have really low expectations because I've spent the last, 12 years training my fiction readers to buy ebooks on Amazon, basically.
Right.
So do you feel like if you start with fiction, particularly where a lot of our readers come from, did it take a while to retrain your readers to want other things?
No, my readers love Kickstarter. I mean, some of them are confused by it, especially some of my older readers, and I have to do a minor amount of hand-holding. But no, Kickstarter actually, like if I do a regular book launch on wide retailers, maybe a couple people will share it. Maybe some people will buy it if I don't do actual advertising. My Kickstarters, people know it's time limited. It's an event. They're excited to participate. And so it spreads, right? My readers do my marketing for me. And then the Kickstarter algorithm kicks in and it does my marketing for me, right? Mm-hmm. It's actually much easier for me than launching something into the void on Amazon or Apple.
Yeah, I'm quite excited to see how it goes. I do want to ask you, because you've mentioned your chronic illness, brain injury, and you talk about the health issues in your book. When we do a Kickstarter, so, you know, you've got the Kickstarter timing, what happens if then something happens in your health that you just can't do it? Or like you said, things get backed up. Like, how are you managing your health issues with the ups and downs of being an author?
Well, it might seem strange to talk about health issues in a business book, but it felt important to me because everyone has something going on in their life, which is why I love this question. And I pad a lot of time into my fulfillment. Like, I try to not plan. I make this mistake all the time where I set out my year's goals when I'm feeling good. And then when I'm not feeling good, I have to deal with those goals and I have to reassess them and pivot and rewrite my production schedule, right? I do it all the time.
No, me too.
But with Kickstarter, I've learned to build in extra time for fulfillment, right? So if you think it's going to take 2 months to fulfill, tell people you'll fulfill in 3 to 4 months, right? If you think you're going to fulfill in 4 months, tell people you're going to fulfill in 6 months. Just add in space. Give yourself grace. And then if you fulfill early, that's awesome. With the campaign I just finished fulfilling, I just told people, hey, here's what's happening with the printer. I'm having these issues. We're working on it. I just kept in communication and people were very kind and happy just to be communicated with. And so I was about a month behind in fulfillment, which is not the end of the world, right?
Yeah, these are books at the end of the day.
Yeah, like seriously, you know. So yeah, just communicate with people. First, build in extra space and time. Build in a buffer and then communicate clearly. And people are very happy to be supportive. Most people want to be kind.
Yes, I agree. So just coming back to your newsletter, because you talked there about communication and earlier you talked about it as the fundamental aspect of your marketing. So what do you do in your newsletter? What do you send out to people? Because I feel like this is something that many authors struggle with.
So I used to barely use my newsletter. Coming out of traditional publishing, I never used a newsletter. I think that's changed now. But I send out a weekly missive about what I'm thinking about. I post a photo of I take on one of my walks and just whatever thoughts I have. And then at the end of this like 300 word missive, I do a line break and a small ad of, you know, here's my latest podcast I'm on, or here's this book that is on sale or has just launched, or here's my Kickstarter, right? So people come back week after week and they know what they're going to get from me is just some thoughts from Thorn. And enough people like that, that some people actually pay me for it, even though it's a free newsletter, right?
And that's on Substack. Is that?
Yeah, I was on Substack for 3 years. I just recently switched to Beehive.
Because of the Nazis?
Yeah, because of the Nazis. Yeah. I mean, it's unfortunate that Substack decided to make those choices. But Substack is still I think it's still a better platform, but Beehive is getting there rapidly. So I have great hope. But that's another thing I changed, right? I used to try to be on ConvertKit and do all the automated sequences that everyone said were best practices for newsletters. And those work for a lot of people. Oh, segment your email list, do these sequences. That marketing never worked for me, ever. So it made putting out my newsletter a chore. Mm. I said, I'm going to stop paying for this. I'm going to go to this free service and I'm going to strip it down and say, here's what I'm doing. Every week, I'm going to send out thoughts with a tiny ad. And that was a huge shift for me. I started that just over three years ago. And people responded. People love the newsletter. People share the newsletter on social media. People reply. People send me long, thoughtful comments. Right? So again, it was figuring out how marketing worked for me.
Mm. That's interesting because I do have two newsletter lists. But actually, when you were talking there, I realized that's what I do on this show is my introduction. It yes. includes the things I'm thinking about.
Yes.
And many people are still listening to your interview, but some people did just come for the introduction.
Yeah. And
so that's actually exactly what you just said. You're doing it in writing. I'm doing it with talking.
Yeah. And I just let it be simple. It's like, okay, here's 300 words. I can write that in 15, 20 minutes. Here's a photo. And it works for me and it works for my readers, which
is
terrific.
It's just being human. It's a connection,
yes.
You said.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think this is the point we talked about earlier. Everyone's quite smart these days around seeing through when things are a gimmick or they're not
yep.
real. I still think that being human and the human connection is important. So, well, let's come to social media then, because again, I think we used to exchange things on Twitter when it was Twitter. A lot of people have moved on from some platforms, and I know you're a super ethical person. So what are you doing with social media now?
Well, first of all, we just all have to figure it out because we live in this world, and I am not judging people who are on various platforms. Losing Twitter was a great loss, right? Twitter was actually my favorite platform. I've tried to get off of Facebook ever since I've been on it. But people won't leave Facebook. Maybe they will eventually, but that has not
when
been my experience.
When everybody dies, when we all die,
so far,
when the old
right,
people
when we,
die.
Yeah, when all the old people die. So I very simply, I only use my public Facebook page. I don't use my private page except to track a few author groups. I do one post, same post, Facebook and Instagram every morning. Usually it's a photo and a thought. I'm on Mastodon, which, strangely enough, Mastodon has no algorithm, and it is my best place to get marketing traction, because people know I'm showing up, making posts, even if it's just one simple post a day. Then when I post something marketing-related, it gets shared. I get more shares on Mastodon than anywhere else, and even though it has no algorithm. And then I'm on Blue Sky, which frankly is useless to me. You know,
no, I did try and get on Threads and I was like, it went toxic so fast.
Oh, Threads is horrific. The comments, I'm like, oh my gosh, the comments on Threads are awful.
Yeah, it's like all the toxicity from Twitter ended up
yes.
on Threads.
Yes, it did. It did. So my social media strategy is very simple. I do one simple post a day, and then I try to remember to occasionally do a marketing post. And then when I'm running a Kickstarter, though, I do a more marketing-related post pretty much every day during my Kickstarter. But since I'm not doing that constantly, people seem supportive of it, right? They're not always getting bombarded by buy my book from me. And so they're really happy to support when I'm running a Kickstarter. They're really happy to do things like share my newsletter when I post my newsletter on social media, things like that.
Mm. And I think your thoughts are, again, you bring in the things you care about, and sometimes that is about protests or art
yeah.
or tattoos or gender issues. I mean, you do just share quite all over the place, I think.
I do. I do. I try to be uplifting as much as possible. If I'm posting about something difficult, I always try to have a call to action that people can actually do instead of, I'm not just on there complaining. My rule for public discourse is I try to be signal and not noise. There's too much noise out there. right? So what is my signal that I'm trying to put out to reach people? And yes, my presence can feel all over the map. And I have felt that about myself, like, you know, here, buy my books, but I'm also talking about magic, but here's a flower that I saw on my walk.
Yeah.
And then here is this social justice thing that's happening. But truly, that's all me. And that is all in my books, too.
And right? That's the point I was trying to make. I didn't mean you were all over the place. I meant you talk about all the things that go into
yes.
your books. Like, you are political and your
yes.
books are political. So if people
yes.
don't want to do politics, then, you know, they're not your person. But people who
exactly.
love your politics will love your books. So
right.
I think that's what I was trying to get at. You are very, I hate the word authentic, but you are pretty
yeah.
authentic.
I can't not be, which is why I just had to figure it out for myself. But what's interesting to me is at this point in the indie author world, I'm hearing this from a lot more people, right? That a lot of people right now are reassessing how they've been marketing and what they've been writing and what they want their careers to look like. I think as a whole in the indie author world, we're taking a step back right now and saying, how do we want to move forward, right? And for me, it always has had to be myself. When I first started publishing fiction, everyone said, you need to do it under a pen name because you're going to pollute your Amazon also bots. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I don't care. I have spent decades building up goodwill with people with my name. I'm just going to write fiction under this name. And well, lo and behold, Amazon also bots quickly went away, right? The Amazon algorithm changes every 6 months to a year.
Oh, I think it changes every week.
Probably. So people who are trying, people have figured out, oh, we can't just chase the algorithm anymore. It doesn't work long term. Mm. So yeah, I came up with a tagline for my author business, and it's magic is real and justice is worth fighting for. And so people know that's what they're going to get from me, no matter what I'm writing or talking about.
Yeah,
a sense of magic and a sense of justice.
And a lot of people want a tagline. I have tried. I think I've even asked you about this before as well. I still don't have a tagline. So, I mean, did it take you a long time to get to that? Or has it always been very clear for you?
What I did, it took me a little while, but it didn't take me that long. I just, again, paused and assessed and said, what do I think my through line is? What are the strongest threads in my work? And what are the strongest threads I want to put out in the world? And that's where it came from. You know, so for you, I think you're really interested in human emotion. I think you're obviously interested in the shadow. You're interested in what makes us tick, right? Mm. So there's something in your work, and I think that also includes your author stuff, right? Your author books over time, I think, have grown to include more and more of your interest in human psychology and philosophy.
Mm. And maybe that's part of it. You know, we're talking as two people who've been doing this a while now. And I feel like that's another thing. And also around your book and talking about the slow growth. Look, some of this stuff takes time, right?
Yes.
None of this appears overnight. And I get people sometimes and they're trying to figure all this out and they haven't even finished their first book yet.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
So patience, I guess.
Patience, and patience is hard. Every new writer wants to be an overnight success. The thing I'll tell you is I've seen people who've been overnight successes. That puts a lot of pressure on the work. And I think it makes it harder to build a long-term career for most people. You know, you start thinking, what if my next book isn't as good? What if people don't like it? Right? Instead of just giving yourself the freedom, frankly, no one knowing who you are is a huge boon to your creativity because you can do whatever you want and find your voice over time. And slowly build an audience over time. Christine Catherine Rush says, we build our career one reader at a time. And I think doubling down on that is helpful. I don't have to reach 100,000 people or even 1,000 people, I want to reach one person, right? Mm. That's where it starts.
Yep, absolutely. Now, there are loads of great tips and things in the book. It's really meaty. It's got lots in it. So tell people about the Kickstarter, where they can find it, and I guess what also when it's running.
So the Kickstarter launches April 16th, and it will run through the first part of May. And I will have some checklists for mid-list mindset changes. I will have some coaching options for people who really want to say, hey, how do I shift my mindset around this stuff? I'm struggling with this area of my writer business. So it's not going to be coaching around like specifics on marketing. It's all going to be mindset coaching. And then, of course, I'll have the ebooks and print books and maybe some other surprises.
Ooh, fantastic. Where else can people find you online?
Thorncoil.com.
Brilliant. Well, thanks so much for your time, Thorn. That was great.
Thanks again for having me back on the show.
So I hope you found the discussion with Thorn interesting and that it encouraged you to think about how you can design a long-term creative lifestyle as an indie author. You can leave a comment on the podcast show notes at thecreativepen.com or on the YouTube channel, or message me on X at thecreativepen with a double N, or email me, joanna@thecreativepen.com. Next week, I'm talking about human-centered book marketing with Dan Blank. And in the meantime, happy writing, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.